Hello, and welcome to State of Our Workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation Learning at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. Each month on State of Our Workforce, we take a journey into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. So picture this. You're working full-time, maybe two jobs, and still can't see a path forward. Your ideas for improving the workplace, nobody's asking. Your share of the company's success, a pizza party maybe, if you're lucky. This is the reality for millions of workers trapped in low-wage jobs with no voice and no stake in their own futures. But here's where it gets interesting. What if the whole game changed? What if, instead of working for a business, workers actually owned it? In this episode, we're diving into employee ownership. Not as some utopian dream, but as a real strategy that's transforming workplaces right now. We'll hear from Rachel McFarlane, founder and senior advisor at Good Future, and Chrissy Schell, executive VP of human resources at SRC Holdings, about how worker ownership is shifting power, profits, and decision-making into the hands of the people actually doing the work. And because we believe in keeping it real around here, Tom Strong and I, Tom, who leads our Activating Industry Leaders work, he and I will share our own spectacular business failures along the way. Spoiler alert, there's wisdom in those wreckage stories. We're exploring the nitty-gritty of how workforce development practitioners can actually support this shift, because changing who owns businesses might just be the key to changing who benefits from our economy. Join us for stories, strategies, and some hard truths about building an economy that works for workers. All right, so we are talking about employee ownerships with some really brilliant people today. So I'm going to ask everybody to weigh in with just maybe like a 30-second introduction of who you are and what you do. Who wants to start? Christy, I'll start with you.
Hey, I'm Chrissy Schell. I'm the Executive Vice President of HR for SRC Holdings. We are a holdings company with currently 12 organizations under the umbrella. All of our organizations work in some facet with remanufacturing of engines and components for a variety of industries, from agriculture, mining, automotive, as well as over-the-road diesel, so diesel and gasoline engines. And we have a logistics company. We also have kitting and packaging. And then we're well known for our business culture because we are an open book management company. We founded the Great Game of Business here at SRC over 40 years ago.
Fantastic. And
we that's one of our organizations that coaches companies all over the world on how to open their books and teach their associates how to be business people. Fantastic. And 100% employee owned. That's pretty important for this conversation.
So, oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure, for sure, for sure. Rachel, how about you?
My name is Rachel McFarlane. I'm the founder of Good Future, which is a strategic advising firm that works in the workforce development and employee ownership spaces. I'm also currently serving as an interim executive director for the Tennessee Center for Employee Ownership, which educates business owners about all things employee ownership in all different forms. And then my background is both as an entrepreneur and a business owner, and as well as a business program director at the San Diego Workforce Partnership before I moved to Tennessee.
And of course, Tom, you don't have to introduce yourself. I'll cut you in there. So this is a conversation I've been looking forward to having. Mostly because when I think of employee ownership, and I want you all to dig into what that actually means, I think about my experience as a small business owner for a short stint. And as I listen to you, Rachel, talk about, you know, what you do and your title, and Christy, what you do,
I think, like, where the hell were these people when I was doing my vegan baking business, you know, however many years ago, which, you know, I said to Christy, I don't know if, you know, employee ownership is for everyone. And she has challenged me on that. So we're going to dig into why that might be the case. But before we get there, talk to me about what it actually means, this employee ownership business. What is it and what is it not? Who wants to dig in?
Well, I can give sort of a big, broad overview. When we talk about employee ownership, we're talking about a suite of business strategies and models that include ownership of the company being shared with ideally all the employees of the company. That's what we call broad-based employee ownership. And that can take many forms. A very common form here in the United States is an employee stock ownership plan, an ESOP. But also worker cooperatives are employee-owned companies, and they have a long, long, long history. Hundreds and hundreds of years in other forms, in other areas of the country and of the world, where communities come together to solve their problems and then share in the work as well as in the profit from that. And so when we talk about employee ownership, we're talking about the people who are creating the value of a company and a business, sharing then in the value that they're creating.
And I will just say, and I will use my experience as a vegan baker, and having a business in that space, already hearing you say that orients me to a whole way of thinking about what could have been done differently, right? Because the weight and the stress of being an employee owner, but this isn't, it's more than just owning the business. It's investment in the responsibilities of it in a way that feels meaningful, that completely shifts. Like you don't have to do it alone, but this, So again, I'm loving this already. All right, Christy, what do you want to answer this part?
So I think it depends on how you actually structure your culture and how you teach about ownership, on whether or not how much of that load gets lifted from you to the employee owners. You know, there are many companies, and people decide things for different reasons that decide to transfer ownership to their associates through ESOP or other means, and don't decide to share a lot of details or information about the company. And what I think you see in that is it's a great gift to the associates no matter what, right? And it helps to share wealth with the people that are creating it. But so in my opinion, based on what I've seen, is that if you also share more information about the organization, in our company, it's completely open book. So we share our financials. We do not share salaries. That sometimes people, you know, that's all rolled into G&A. But we share information about the companies. And so it takes that, it does truly share the load and the responsibility of where the company is going, because it's not just the top leadership that is seeing how things are going and trying to adjust and tell everyone else, you know, what they think they need to do. Everybody sees it. They see, you know, this particular month is down or this quarter is down, and you get this bottom up input from the people that are actually doing the work, and a lot more brains working on how to solve it and how to get to profitability or to grow your company so you can sleep a little better at night. But it's a choice in how much you share and what that ownership really feels like to the individual, and whether it's an additional retirement plan and they see that once a year in a stock certificate type, you know, or an ESOP certificate. Or whether they're actually seeing the impact of the financials on a regular basis throughout the year and how their contributions are impacting that.
So I love a good story. And I mean, you mentioned a very important point that your company is an employee owned, 100% employee owned. What's the story behind that?
Got a minute? So I'm happy to share the story. So, SRC was actually originally a part of the International Harvester Organization back in the late 70s. And so our founder and CEO, Jack Stock, was working in Illinois at the International Harvester facility. He had worked his way up and was actually asked to come run what was called the Springfield Renew Center in Springfield in the late 70s. When he got here, in his late 20s, basically, he was sent to come down and run this organization. They started to fall, International Harvester and really the economy in general started to fall on hard times through the late 70s and early 80s. And International Harvester was particularly having tough times and were laying off thousands of people per week. They were hemorrhaging cash. They were shutting down facilities all over the country. And they, you know, Jack knew his, it was just a matter of time that they would get the phone call and he would be asked to shut the facility down. And it finally did come. The call came and he went to his other 12 managers and he'll tell you he did it somewhat just to have no guilt if they said no, but he went to them and said, hey, do you guys want to take a run at buying this company from International Harvester? Because if you look at, you know, early 80s, and there weren't other jobs, you know, inflation was super high. Unemployment was super high. They were young. They had families. And if this facility closed, they were basically losing their job and there wasn't anyone down the street. So those managers said, of course, yes, we want to do this. And so they made a, you know, made a run at buying the company. International Harvester said, sure, you can buy it for $9 million. They didn't have $9 million. They, the 13 managers scraped together $100,000 by borrowing from friends and family. And then Jack set off on the path to buy the, to find some, a bank that would actually give them a loan for $8.9 million. And it took them about 50 banks. It was about a 2-year process. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about a bank that was kind of looking at riskier loans. And he gave him a call and said, I hear you're booking bad loans and I got a doozy for you. And they gave him, so he went and met with them and they gave him the loan, came back. It was, it's known as one of the worst loans in corporate history because it was 89-to-1 debt to equity, 18% interest. And he came back and what they had to do, they knew they had to make that loan payment and they had to make payroll or they would never, all this work was for nothing, right? So they started, that's why we opened the books is because they started looking at, you know, we need all, there was about 119 people. He's like, we need everybody rowing in the right direction and understanding what our goal is in order to be able to be profitable so that we can make these, make payroll and make the payment. And so he started opening up the books. And in that, he, there was two things that he kind of made commitments to as he was doing, trying to get that that loan. One was that he learned in that process that the manufacturing variances and KPIs he'd been taught, the bank didn't care about that. You know, the bank just wanted to know what the cash flow was and if it was actually going to be a profitable business and they could pay them back on the loan. And the other thing is that he realized it took everybody. And so he, from the very beginning, wanted to share equity with everyone in the company. When he first made that, he asked the bank if they would be interested in that. And they're like, no, we're not going to chase 119 people down to get this payment. You know, you can't put everybody down as owners. But ESOPs were pretty new at the time, and they learned about it. And so they put the ESOP in from the very beginning whenever SRC became its own organization. So that is the story.
Okay, so quickly, and for our listeners who are brand new to this conversation, ESOP stands for?
Employee Stock Ownership Plan.
Okay. So the thing that's the bells that are ringing in my head, particularly, I mean, you talked about the environment in which this company was started. Inflation was high. Like things were not great. So mm-hmm. parallels, obviously, to where we where we are now. So I think like so for so many people. In turbulent times, they hunker down. And what I hear you saying is that, I mean, that is an option, but there's also space to innovate. Like this is a place, this is a time that calls mm-hmm. for innovation, which pings me over to Tom, our dear director of Activating Industry Leaders, because he has been on this at the National Fund for a long time and really brought us all into this conversation and has been critical in shifting our thinking on this. Tom, talk more about the parallels and why the National Fund is a good fit to engage in this conversation and kind of, and to push this work forward.
Yeah, well, I think it helps to start thinking again about Chrissy's story and SRC. Like, where are the parallels, right? So one of the most fundamental parallels is that in workforce development, our job is to help people get out of poverty, to help people to help themselves by making more money. Like, there's a lot of other important stuff in there, but fundamentally, that's what it's all about. Historically, in the workforce development sector, we tend to focus the most on helping people build their skills, develop a career pathway, advance in companies, and that's all great stuff. It's one way out of poverty, and it's one way to build wealth, but it's not the only way. Chrissy is illuminating this other way, which is by being a worker in a company that has an employer of choice and that actually shares equity with its employees. Those people built wealth over, like, people who stuck with SRC built wealth over decades. There are people who were in that original 120 or so employees at SRC who are millionaires now because they were investors fundamentally in this growing company. And there's a lot of attention and excitement around this topic of employee ownership among nonprofits right now because those impacts are there in a lot of companies. And Rachel was involved with the Employee Ownership Expansion Network. That's another organization that's trying to drive this conversation forward with employee ownership. This is a wealth-building strategy that connects to workforce development. And one reason it connects is because there are skills you need when you're an owner of a company that are distinct when you are just working at the company.
Again, why I'm so excited about this conversation, maybe because it's cathartic and me thinking back on my experience as a baker and owning a business. And so Rachel, this is where I'm going to bring you into the conversation, because one of the things that I said a lot was like, oh, wait a minute, I'm the recipe developer, the tester, the driver to the stores, the marketer, like I keep the books. And I, you know, there's no one I can get to come into this that will have the same level of engagement as I will, because I'm the owner of the business. But that was flawed thinking. So it goes beyond just being thinking that you're smart and you have an idea and you have a good product. It takes more than that, which is why I was like, where were the Rachels and Chris, where were the Christies when I was thinking about when I was doing this years ago? And so Rachel, weigh in on this. What do you want to add to this?
Well, I love the entrepreneur story as somebody who also started a business, a small business with my husband, and wore pretty much all the hats other than the creative director piece, which was his area. It's hard. It's hard to start a business. And then when you realize you need talent to help you grow the business or expand, you're like, I can't do everything. I mean, my story was, you know, you did what everyone else in the startup community did and what we were told to do, which is go to the gig economy and hire people off of Fiverr and Upwork and, you know, bring them in. And they do become kind of part of your team, but like, they're not employees yet. I don't have a benefits program. I don't have salaries. I'm barely paying myself, right? And so what is interesting is that, I mean, for my story, my origin story in business, we were also taught in this startup ecosystem, which is primarily funded and resourced by private equity investors, that the goal about a startup is like, unless you're a lifestyle business, which I hate, like this degradatory term, which is actually more aligns with our values. The whole goal here is like build fast, build quick, scale really hard, sell for a lot of money so that the investors can get their money out, right? And then you can retire on a beach with a little umbrella in your drink. Not my goal here, but it was really hard as we were growing the business and we needed to hire folks for me to say, like, I don't know how I can do this and also provide like quality employment to them and quality pay. And that eventually led to me not doing the business. And that's how I got involved in workforce development and job quality, was helping businesses navigate those same challenges, but at a larger scale. But it's an interesting topic because a lot of businesses that want to solve that problem, the place where they can start with employee ownership is with worker cooperatives. So you'll also hear employee ownership called worker ownership. And one of the reasons that sometimes we like to prefer the term worker ownership is because you can have a worker cooperative, which is a group of people coming together to solve their own problems, working together in this team environment, sharing the challenges and the decision-making, and also sharing the profits and the benefits and figuring out what solutions do we need in order to like solve our day-to-day problems and grow our business. But not all of those workers are necessarily employees.
Right.
In the service industry, for instance, there's a worker co-op that was just established here by a lot of wellness professionals who are independent contractors. And they're tired of this very extractive environment where they have to go and rent a booth at a salon or, you know, an estheticians or these industries. And so you think about service professionals who right now they just launched in February and they're so empowered by coming together, pooling their resources. And instead of them each paying, you know, $500 a month booth rent to some landlord tenant, they're putting that money together, renting a space themselves, and they're coming up with brilliant ideas. Like, we know somebody who has a drop-in childcare business that would love to actually host at our place. And then people can come and experience their services, whether it's esthetician or hairdressing, and have a place to drop off their kids. And so we can now meet the needs also of our customers and our communities in a better way and have the flexibility to be able to do that without this kind of needing to go and ask for permission. And so worker cooperatives are also just, this model exists in many, 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 like, huge volumes in other areas in the country. I'm sorry, other areas of the world. And there's huge communities there. And it's got traction here. And I think that that's, like, from a startup ecosystem standpoint, like, that is potentially one of the ways that people who are finding themselves out of work, who have skills, who are jaded with employment, like traditional employment. I don't want to go back and work for somebody who's going to tell me what to do. I think entrepreneurship and encouraging entrepreneurship and supporting entrepreneurship through these cooperative models is actually a really promising model for the future, especially in industries that lack, like systemically lack job quality. When you think about service industry, you think about the care economy.
Yeah.
You think about these areas that, like, as a workforce professional, it's like, how do we bring job quality to childcare or to home health care? There are worker cooperatives that are doing that and are able to then, because they're collaborating on solutions, they're building ideas, they're thinking with an owner's mindset, and they're collaborating together, they're bought into the success together, they're able to come up with very creative policies to solve their problems, to pay themselves with living wages, and to create their own job quality.
Yeah. So then this brings me to a question about access, right? And I think about, again, using my own experience, I had a lot of book knowledge. I spent a lot of time in academia. I had a good product. People told me I had a good product, like all of those kinds of things. I did not have the skills that you're talking about to be a business owner. Right? So that was one area, but I'm also thinking about investments. You know, Christy, your story about identifying folks who could get a certain amount of money to contribute to, you know, to buy the business. That still feels out of range, both of what we're talking about, or even, you know, going online and finding temp folks to help you with work. All is still out of range for lots of folks. So how does this become accessible in a way that everyone who wants to get in on this can get on this?
So let me clarify. So in the beginning, when I was telling the origin story, those 13 managers did have to buy in, basically, right? But an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program, that is not, that you do not buy in. And so everyone does have the accessibility of that. We contribute to their ESOP funds every year. And for our organizations, we contribute an equivalent of 6 to 8%. I can always say that's always our average. Sometimes some years it's more. But we contribute an equivalent of 6 to 8% of their payroll, of their wages for the year into their ESOP. And then that allows them, they see. So then as our company value increases, so that they buy stock, right, with those ESOP contributions, they don't, the system does, they, you know, and then so that combination of that contribution plus the increases in the value of the organization is how they generate wealth through the ESOP.
This is so helpful, right? I mean, because it's a lot, right? And thinking through, and so answering, so I appreciate the clarification on that because that makes a lot of sense. Rachel, you want to weigh in on something? Did you have?
Okay. Yeah, I just have to say, like, there's a really, the employee ownership ecosystem, I use this word a lot, but there is a whole ecosystem that is, and this is, I mean, from workforce development folks and the National Fund, who's kind of on the innovative edge of this, to like banks and financing institutions, technical service providers, consulting and advisory firms, other kinds of alternative funds, industry organizations. This whole ecosystem is working on really building awareness of employee ownership and beginning to fill a lot of those gaps around what are these resources? What is the education? How do I learn about this? And so if you're listening to this for the first time, there are a ton of resources out there now that did not exist 30 years ago. And I'm happy to chat about some of those, but from like, just to piggyback on the financing conversation, say you're an employee of a company or a leader at a company that's facing a similar decision, right? That Jack was facing at SRC, however many years ago, you can, you know, have these conversations. There's a valuation of the company. There are many impact focused investors. There are banks. There's even like an SBA 7 lending program that now does ESOP transactions and other kinds of transactions as well. And so the business essentially leverages its value to take out a loan, to buy out the owner. The employees pay nothing, but now, you know, the company has an appropriate amount of debt to pay out that owner. And then over time, the company pays off the debt. So the employees, again, do not have to buy in. And what's really incredible, like this also just deserves saying, is that when a company becomes 100% employee owned as an S corp through an ESOP, like an ESOP arrangement, that company doesn't pay any federal income tax.
Oh, wow.
It's tax, it operates tax free in perpetuity. Hmm. And so think about the savings from a business standpoint. You don't have to pay taxes.
Right.
You can use that to reinvest in the company, in the business, as well as in the workforce, the benefits programs, and other things. And that's one of the things that has set ESOPs apart as hugely competitive businesses that can also then create really amazing job quality programs and have highly engaged workforces when they pair that financial structure with a really good employee ownership mindset development and culture investment and bringing the employees along on this journey in the way that SRC has done with open book management. And as Tom mentioned earlier, that is an opportunity for workforce development folks, especially with some of the changes that are going on with like WIOA expenditures and with business and customized business training and working with industry. There's an opportunity to say, hey, we want to get creative with our funds and our training funds, and financial awareness and financial acuity and ownership mindset is really important to teach workers, regardless of if they're at an employee-owned company or not. Like there are some that have different, like they're precursors to employee-owned and they're doing the good work. But this is empowering workers with the knowledge that they need to make business decisions, which would be what they would need to do if they're going to be an employee owner.
Well, and I mean, it's what I hear you saying, that it's part of the career navigation space, right? In terms of wherever you are currently in your work or your employment, it goes beyond that. It's like, it's planting seeds in a way. And this is, again, this is very fascinating to me. Tom, you look like you want to weigh in on something, did you?
Yeah.
And before you do that, I just want to clarify, Rachel didn't say this, but it wasn't 30 years ago that I tried to start my business. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I was talking about Jack. I'm thinking it was about 30 years ago, right, Chrissy? And,
42.
That's me being I'm a comedian too, in my mind too. So that's me. Okay. All right, go ahead, Tom. What you got?
We have a lot of comedians at the National Fund, by the way.
This is true. This is true.
Okay. First of all, just a quick timeout for a useful detail and a context. And Michelle, I've made this mistake myself, so I offer this feedback for you. It's Chrissy, not Christy.
Oh, thank you.
Just don't want you to kick yourself later.
For sure. Please, this is an open space. You can push back on my thinking or correct me. Like there's no, I don't claim perfection or knowledge of all of this space. So thank you.
I also just want to note, like, a couple of our members at the National Fund have done work in this space, particularly around worker co-ops, as Rachel was discussing. So I know Skillworks in Boston did some work exploring the supporting employee-owned worker co-ops, specifically in the home care space a couple years ago as one of our projects. I believe Rework the Bay has also done some work with co-ops. There's quite a few co-ops in their region. So this is a place where our members are starting to get more involved. We also have worked with some, our members have worked with some ESOPs, which is the predominant form. And there are some surprisingly big ESOPs in the US. So like the biggest ESOP of all, not many people know this, is Publix, grocery stores. Our members in Des Moines worked with Hy-Vee for a number of years, which is another large grocery store that is employee owned. So there are employee owned companies that are already part of our network. It's more about raising the consciousness of that, I think, right now.
Can I also, I wanted to add just a bit to what Rachel was sharing about, because I think as you've got, we've got so many baby boomers right now that are considering, you know, what do they do next? Or what, they've built this great company, they've got this great culture, they care deeply about their employees. And so, you know, employee ownership is a great succession planning tool for them if they want to look at giving ownership to their, and I think that is
a great point
in this, in our day and age, that is, it's something that we're seeing over and over. The other thing is that I think you mentioned the precursor, like we have lots of great game practitioners that are not employee owned. It's a matter of, it drives that engagement, right? And people, whether it is full ownership, and they're getting equity, or it's that psychic ownership that, wow, I actually understand how this business works and I know what my contribution is. We've found it to be very successful in driving engagement.
So Chrissy, now that I am pronouncing your name correctly, I apologize for that. Let's talk about some of the myths that show up in this space, and let's do some myth busting around this. And I also, just as before we close out, I really want us to dig more into the open books part of the work, because that's a huge piece of it, and we engage in that at the National Fund. But let's bust some myths right now. What's the biggest thing that people think and you're like, that's not true? Yeah. Or maybe one is mine, was just like, not everybody should be an owner. That's Mythbuster one.
Sure. I can give you a kind of a list, but I mean, one I think we already busted was that people have to pay in, right? That people have to buy shares. No, that is not how employee ownership works in these different scopes that we're looking at, right? Mm-hmm. The other is, well, if I'm an owner, I can, I get to make ultimate decisions, right? And I get to hire and fire. And, that those are still things that are depending, they're role specific, right? Whether you're a supervisor or a manager, it's role specific in those kind of responsibilities. And when we talk about ownership, it's because you have equity in the company, right? That you're going to share in the wealth, not necessarily that you're going to get to do everything that a CEO does. We do really look at that buy-in, and we want the feedback. And we feel strongly that no one understands how to do the job better than the person doing it. So if that person has ideas, we want to hear those and we will act on those. So those are things that are a big part of the culture. Those are probably some of the biggest myths, is that you have to buy things. And then I think just to that point where you're talking about not everybody might be cut out to be an owner. What we find often, I mean, people like to be smart, right? They like to learn. They like to know more about what's happening, then go home and tell their family that they know the ins and outs of the business. People are smart. And if you give them the information and the opportunity, and it's through that repetition. So, from the open book side of things, it's like what we find is that whenever we share financials with people in a way that it's the stories behind the numbers. Personally, like I my degree is in psychology and minor in HR. I steered away from finance as much as possible through the early part of my career because I'm not a math person, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, ugh, I don't want to do that. And then I worked in a small software startup. We had a cash crisis and we had to do a few rounds of layoffs. And all of a sudden I was like, wow, I need to understand this. This is not just, I can't just power down whenever somebody starts talking about the financials. This matters. And so we actually implemented pieces of the Great Game of Business when I was in that organization. And then I had the chance to come over here because during that time, I really wanted to increase my business acumen. I wanted, even though it's not my, not something that I just naturally gravitate to, I'm not a human calculator. It's not my thing, but you can understand. And once you start to do that repetition, even if you're, that isn't your strongest skill set, my skill set in that area has grown tremendously because I get to be a part of it. And I look at it as the stories behind the numbers, right? It's not just a spreadsheet. What is the input for that? Where are our sales at? What are our costs? You know, what is our G&A and how can we affect these things? And then it starts to come to life. You know, what's our cash flow? Do we have cash? You know, that is a big deal, especially given my history. We have cash. Is this going to continue? You know, and so that's part of that learning that I have found to be so rewarding in that. And I've just seen people start to get it, right? The light bulbs go off. And then what's super cool about that is then they take that information and they apply it at home and they start to put a budget together and they start to look at their own income as that revenue line and all the expenses. And we've seen generational change and such a difference in decision-making, people setting up goals to pay off their house, pay off their car, you know, get out of debt. And once you give people the tools, then the magic happens to be able to see how they can use it.
Wow. This is great. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
I got two more myths for you.
Okay.
So one is the flip side of what Chrissy was just talking about. And this is a myth that really takes place among employers who have made that transition to employee ownership, which is that you can expect that if you give people stock in the company, that is suddenly going to turn into ownership thinking and that everyone will have that fire under them immediately. And it doesn't work that way. And then companies get disappointed because it doesn't have that immediate effect. The training, the process that Chrissy talks about as open book management is a big part of teaching people the skills they need to be effective owners and to really understand what their investment in this company is doing and how they can contribute to it. So I think that's an important myth for setting expectations. And it is part of why we at the National Fund are also exploring open book management at this point as a tool in our toolkit. The other myth has to do with something, it's tangentially related, but I think it's important, that's more prominent in the nonprofit world, which is the idea that if you teach people personal finance, they are going to be able to climb up out of poverty and kind of make all these big changes in their lives without actually offering a vehicle for them to make more money. And we, you know, financial wellness has been a skill set that we have taught people in this sector for many, many years now. It is frequently disappointing in the outcomes. And the reason it's frequently disappointing is because poor people know how to manage their own money. They are better at it than many of us are. They just have less of it to work with. And I think part of what's exciting about both employee ownership and open book management is it actually is this win-win scenario where if your employer does better, then you also do better and you have more leeway to actually apply these financial skills you're developing at work to your personal life.
And I would love to just like hop one level up even from that, Tom, and say, I think that many people, especially many working people who feel very disenfranchised right now by our economic system, are realizing that there's this American myth that exists, this mentality that if we work hard enough, that we'll be able to get ahead and we'll be able to create our own economic future and we'll be able to lead a good life and we'll be able to thrive. And there's a problem right now in the United States where people who do work hard for a living aren't making a living. They're not making a living. They're not making it. They're not making it working one or two jobs. And the flip side of that myth is that ownership builds wealth. If you do not have inherited generational wealth and assets, then you have to start somewhere. And historically, at least when I was growing up, I got, you know, drilled into my head, you got to buy a home and real estate and home ownership is the way to go. And as somebody who still at 40 years old has not purchased my first home, I know how hard it is. Like, it is really hard everyone in my generation, everyone who lives around me that didn't grow up with money or really good jobs has totally lost hope about building a, about buying a home. The third way to build wealth is through business ownership. And we know that entrepreneurship is not the journey for everyone.
Right, right.
I am not going to start a product business again. I never want to do e-commerce again. No, thank you. And so by becoming an employee owner of a company that already shares that ownership with employees is a way for everyday Americans who just want to go up, go to work, show up, do good work, and be appropriately compensated for their work. It's a way for them to flip that script around, like this very negative outlook that a lot of working people have right now, where they don't believe that it's possible to change your economic future. And I would just say to everyone who feels like they're in that situation, try to find an employee-owned company and go work for it, or spread the good news about employee ownership so that we have more of these opportunities.
Again, tons of light bulbs. So I will say, going back to just using my story to cathartically revisit like the failure of that for me. We used some funds, some inheritance money and a little 401k money, but the jumping off point when we needed more money I'm not comfortable because we did not come from money in ways that we had. There were deep pockets available to us, and come on, vegan baking. I mean,
it's a big thing right now.
It's a big thing now.
You are ahead of your time, Michelle.
People didn't see my vision fully like 20 years ago. I get that, but not willing to go to dip into that anymore, right? Like the risk was not something that we were willing to take, and so hopping off at that point rather than digging into what we had available to us didn't feel safe. But hearing Chrissy talk about what's the resources that are available, there were so many other options. And so, Tom, my point in this is, had you know Chrissy and Rachel been available to me 20 years ago, I would not be your colleague right now. So, you know,
we all have a journey.
We all have a journey.
Michelle, we haven't talked about this much, but I've been a business owner twice and I have failed both times. the first time was as a small business team that came out of my MBA program. We tried to launch a VC business. 2008 turns out was not a great year to be doing what we were doing. It was
the worst year.
It was a lettuce growing hydroponic farm in a desert. We actually had a lot of promise, I thought, but we made some major mistakes.
2008 was when I was doing my jam too, right?
Oh, so there perfect. We are. And then I worked as a solopreneur for several years as a consultant, like Rachel is doing now. And while I loved that work, I needed more of a community to work with. Like I knew that I thrive best as an owner when I'm a co-owner with other people rather than a solopreneur. And there are people who are cut out for that. There definitely are. But I think our society is trying to build consciously or unconsciously towards a world where that is the normal form of not just entrepreneurship, but work. And a lot of the technological changes that we're seeing now, like drive more and more towards people, the gig economy and people working as solopreneurs. And I do feel like there's employee ownership offers a community level way of thinking about this that I think is much needed right now.
I'm totally loving this conversation, and I can't wait to make sure that there are people in my life and my surroundings like, you should listen to this podcast. I have a lot of good stuff to say. Not that I don't hype the podcast normally, but this is really good stuff. So we're almost at time, and I want to know from Chrissy and Rachel, what haven't we talked about that you want to put out there, or what should we be thinking about, or what's the call to action for folks who are in this space? Let's do that. What's the call to action here for people who are thinking about it and people who are thinking about supporting people in this space?
I have a lot to say on that, but Chrissy, you go first.
Okay. I think exploring it, you know, especially those that we've said, I think most of the things here, but I do think one of the things that we maybe haven't, maybe hit as strongly is that this employee ownership in whatever methodology you use to do that it is a way of generating wealth for and closing that gap between the haves and the have-nots. And in order to help people, especially help people that may have been in generational poverty, it does take the tools. I appreciate what Tom said. You can't just give equity and then expect things to magically happen, right? But it is a way. I would love to see that divide close more and more. And I'm not, I'm a realist also, but these companies that share wealth with their associates, they see hyper growth too, because you have more people pulling to actually grow that organization. And we're helping people. We're helping people make changes, not only in their lives, but in the lives of their children and those to come. And if a baby boomer, if somebody's looking at retiring and they're trying to figure out what to do, I would just highly encourage them to look into this as an option, because it'll feel good, and you're going to make a big impact on a lot of lives.
Okay. Rachel, go.
So for the specific audience, for the majority of the audience, which is workforce professionals and workforce practitioners and those who are in this space, one, I would just say, like Chrissy said, learn about it. Mm-hmm. Like, learn about it, learn about which employee-owned companies are in your community that you can partner with, because guess what? They're probably going to have better jobs, and they're producing more better job opportunities for your participants in your programs. It's also a way to extend economic opportunity to excluded workers, because if you support a business like a worker cooperative that has workers who can't maybe traditionally be served by the WIOA system, like, you're supporting those workers through the business. Another huge thing, and this is how I got into employee ownership, is we mentioned earlier, there's this huge wave of retiring business owners. It's something like 50% of small business owners are going to retire in the next 10 years. And what are they going to do? And business owners don't want to sell to a competitor. They don't want their company to be bought by somebody who's going to turn it inside out, fire half their employees, and take the operations outside of their community. And so retaining local businesses, which circulate 3 times more wealth in your community, is also a huge thing that workforce should be participating with employee ownership on, especially around layoff aversion, rapid response programs. And there are some models for that. The other thing that I just want to say is that, I mean, I came from workforce development, and when I started doing employee ownership transition programs using rapid response dollars at the Workforce Partnership, I was like, this is the niche of the niche strategies. Mm-hmm. Like, this is so far out there. I don't know if any other workforce boards would ever do this. As I've gotten more involved in the employee ownership space, I just want to say to everyone, this is not going away. This is a very promising strategy, an economic strategy that impacts the world of workforce. And when workforce practitioners are engaged in this conversation, they are actually ahead of the curve. Last month, the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions held a bipartisan hearing called Empower Workers by Expanding Employee Ownership. I highly recommend you all go and read the testimonies of the businesses that presented. We had Senate, like, Democrat and Republican senators. We had companies from Vermont down to Alabama testifying to the benefits of employee ownership across industries, across state lines, across political divides. It's truly a unifying strategy, and it's not going away. So school up on it, learn about it. If there are businesses that are listening to this and they want to learn more, there are so many resources. They can reach out to me, and I will, like, fan them out to all the folks I work with, so that I don't have to, like, do the list here, or we can also put some links if that's helpful.
Yeah, we can follow up with that. That's great. Tom, you want the last word on this?
Yeah, I'll keep this really basic. There's a very useful organization out there called Certified Employee Owned. They've got a website, certifiedeo.com. If you are a workforce professional, go there. They've got a full listing of employee-owned companies across the country. You can search in your metro area and figure out which employee-owned companies are near you. Give them a call. Go visit them. Learn about what they're doing. You might find something. You might learn something interesting to work on together.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all for allowing both Tom and I to divulge our failed business practices as exemplars for how it didn't have to be this way. worked out, but there you go. Chrissy, I appreciate you. Rachel, I appreciate you both, very knowledgeable. And we look forward to continuing the conversation in the future around this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank y'all.
Thank you.
This was great.
State of Our Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. To stay updated on State of Our Workforce and all things workforce development, be sure to follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn. Don't forget to subscribe to our State of Our Workforce wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more valuable conversations in the future. Remember, everybody, life is tricky, so stay in your magic.